commence reading from verse 1 through to the end of the chapter. Hear, O Lord, my righteous plea. Listen to my cry. Give ear to my prayer. It does not rise from deceitful lips. May my vindication come from you. May your eyes see what is right. That you probe my heart and examine me at night. That you test me, you will find nothing. I have resolved that my mouth will not sin. As for the deeds of men, by the word of your lips, I have kept myself from the ways of the violent. My steps have held to your path, my feet have not slipped. I call on you, O God, for you will answer me. Give ear to me and hear my prayer. Show the wonder of your great love, you who save by your right hand, those who take refuge in you from their foes. Keep me as the apple of your eye. Hide me in the shadow of your wings from the wicked who assail me, from my mortal enemies who surround me. They close up their callous hearts and their mouths speak with arrogance. They have tracked me down. They now surround me. My eyes alert to throw me to the ground. They are like a lion hungry for prey, like a great lion crouching in cover. Rise up, O Lord. Confront them, bring them down, rescue me from the wicked by your sword. O Lord, by your hand, save me from such men, from men of this world whose reward is in this life. You still the hunger of those you cherish. Their sons have plenty, and they store up wealth for their children. And I, in righteousness, I will see your face. When I awake, I will be satisfied with seeing your likeness.
Just read this poem because it's something of how I feel as I approach the life of David and how to go about it. It was six men of Indostan, two learning, much inclined, who went to see the elephant, though all of them were blind, that each by observation might satisfy his mind. The first approached the elephant, and happening to fall against his broad and sturdy side, at once began to bawl, "God bless me! But the elephant is very like a wall." The second, feeling of the tusk, cried, "Ho, what have we here? So very round and smooth and sharp, to me 'tis mighty clear, this wonder of an elephant is very like a spear." The third approached the animal, and happening to take the squirming trunk within his hand, thus boldly up and spake, "I see," quoth he, "the elephant is very like a snake." The fourth reached out an eager hand and felt about the knee. "What most this wondrous beast is like is mighty plain," quoth he. "'Tis clear enough the elephant is very like a tree." The fifth, who chanced to touch the ear, said, "E'en the blindest man can tell what this resembles most. Deny the fact, who can? This marvel of an elephant is very like a fan." The sixth, no sooner had begun about the beast to grope than seizing on the swinging tail that fell within his scope, "I see," said he, "the elephant is very like a rope." And so these men of Indostan disputed loud and long, each in his own opinion, exceeding stiff and strong, though each was partly in the right and all were in the wrong. I trust as we look at David, we only just take a little snapshot of David, that we get a real impression of who David is and some of the chief characteristics that marked his life. Because it's very easy when we got a man on which there is so much written to just take a little snapshot and we could be like one of these men and get a completely wrong impression, even though what we say might be correct. And we just pray that God will guard us from it as we would look at this, the life of David. Briefly, we come across him as a very young lad. Now, he certainly hadn't developed into the period where you change from boyhood to youth to manhood. He hadn't developed into that stage when we first come across him. And as you read the story of David, it is a very exciting story. It is very interesting. There is almost every aspect that a person would run into that would draw our interest and our attention as you would read the life of David. If you're a young person and you like Rambo type things, some of the things that David's mighty men would make Rambo look like a Boy Scout. If you're interested in deception, there's deception in this story about David as you read in his life and the people that are associated with him. If you're looking for action, there's that. If you're looking for romance, there's beautiful stories about that and illustrations for us. If we're wanting to know what a real friend is, you will find it in this story. And if you want to know about adultery and its consequences, you read it in this story. Almost anything that man takes and makes a big issue out of, we can see in this story, but we get God's imprint on it and we see the consequences that are the results of getting involved in a lot of these things. So if you want to really get a proper perspective on all these issues of life and the things that confront us, read this story of David. You will get a proper perspective of how God sees it, and as you read it, not only is it interesting, but if you ask the Lord to speak to you from it, it will teach your heart so many things. Now, as we speak about David, we will see some great high points, but as the Bible portrays its heroes, it also shows us their weaknesses. And if we look at David's weaknesses, and we'll look at a couple hopefully this morning, it is not in a critical attitude, because as I see these things in David, I can't criticise him if I look into my own heart and how far short I fall and how the sins that were evident in David's life are probably multiplied in mine. But as we look at this life, may the Lord speak to each one of us and challenge us. Just in opening, if you look at your sheet, you will see that there are so many ways you could look at David's life. Now, we've taken a completely different tack, and just the other day I pulled out a book to have a look at a reference in it, and I found a pencil note that Dad had written in it, and he just used it as a bookmark, and he looked at it, and he just had some headings in the on David, and he was talking about him. His whole life was a school. And he used these areas, and I can't quote it properly, but I'll paraphrase it. But as a shepherd, he was in training. As a musician, as a working in the court of the king, then as a soldier, then out in the wilderness in exile, he could write that he was as a partridge on the mountains. And then finally, when he becomes a king, we see him in the school of God's chastening. Now, there's another way you could look at David's life, a lifetime of training. So we come across David while he's still a lad. And we read about that in 1 Samuel chapter 16. And we're not going to comment too much about these points, but we'll just mention them. But as you read that portion there, you will find that he's the first king that God chose. Now, he wasn't the first king of Israel, but he was the first king of Israel that was chosen by God. The people had cried out that they wanted a king, and God had said through Samuel to choose a king, and the people had chosen Samuel. God had taken said that he'd taken the kingdom from Saul, and he was going to anoint another king. And Samuel goes to the house of Jesse. Now, we might say, if we looked at his heritage, we'd say he came from a fairly good background, because of what was it, his great grandparents were Ruth and Boaz. David is born into this household. But Samuel comes and he goes to anoint the future king. So he comes to Jesse's house and asks him to bring all his family together. because he's going to have a sacrifice and so on, if you read the story. So Jesse brings out all his sons and he brings out seven of his children. And God's not interested in any of them. Now you get a physical description of some of his sons in this portion. Now, but can you imagine it? And I thought it was significant. The seven sons standing up. Now, seven is the biblical number of perfection. And we see a perfect example of the flesh all arrayed before Samuel, and God says, I'm not interested in any of them. None of them are the man that I've marked out. And it says, the authorized version that says, Jesse had a younger son. Now, if you look at the word that he uses, it says it's small and is small. And the meaning behind it is, even Jesse thought he was insignificant. When he was asked to bring his family, he didn't bring David. He left him out in the looking after the sheep. But from a man's point of view, he was insignificant. And if God's going to call us and use us and have a work for us, his calling is contrary to human reasoning. Now Samuel, even though he knew he had to go and appoint a king, he was still sensitive to what God said to him. But as he looked, he thought it was one of the others. But he listened to God. God had set David out as his king. So if God's going to use us, it'll be often contrary to human reasoning. Secondly, it's conditioned on our heart's response. Was this the first time that God had had a dealing with David? Why did God use David? He'd seen his attitude and his heart response out looking after the sheep. Isn't this the man that wrote the 23rd Psalm? I'm not saying he wrote this psalm while he was still a lad, but the attitude of his heart during that time God would see, and it was conditioned on his heart's response, God's call. Thirdly, it was characterised by heavenly recognition. God's going to recognise if God's called us. Now, to David, it was clear that God had called him to be king. Later on, it became evident to so many else that God had marked him out. You read the story of David and you read that they quote and say that God's anointing him to be king. Even Saul himself could say that God was with David and he was going to be king. And you read about David acting wisely and God with him, and Saul could see it and it left him quite desolate. And I tried to make them all D's. I had some difficulty and I had to play around with some, as you can see with the headings. However, you got the message. God's call. This is some years later, the next incident we want to have a look at. And it's in 1 Samuel chapter 17. And it's where David meets Goliath. We know the story, so we're not going to go into it, but just some characteristics. If I'm a Christian and God's going to use me, I'm going to have to be able to defeat the enemy. And just to have to get a perspective and get some idea on some of the characteristics of David, I just thought I'd list some of the characteristics of Saul and see why Saul couldn't be used to defeat the enemy. How often in my own life do I find that I'm unable to defeat my Goliath? Now, each of us have a Goliath. He may not be the physical giant that's portrayed in a story, but it's a giant that in our own strength we can't defeat. What my Goliath is may not be yours, but do we know the victory in defeating our Goliath? Just have a look at some of the characteristics of Saul and we'll see why he couldn't stand up to Goliath. Firstly, we find his jealousy, and it's in his heart. We see it evident in his life later on, and that's where it's brought out in chapter 18. but in his life that was there, it was in his heart. We see Saul's desolation. We go back earlier into Saul's experience, and he'd rejected God's word, the word of God. He'd become impatient with God's delays, but he still had a form and he could still go through the motions. When he sets David up with his armoury and David comes to him, he said to David, God be with you. It sounded okay, but in his life, here he was, a pathetic figure. As you read this story, he was a strapping person, the leader of the nation that had claimed God to be their own, and he's a pathetic figure. He's unable to defeat the enemies of God, and this person, Goliath, could bring into disrepute almost the name of God, and he's unable to defeat him. But look at the characteristics of his life. Do I experience that in mine? Let's have a look at David. We see, and you read the story, there's confidence in God. He's encouraged by his past experiences. And it says that God was with him. How can he do all these things? When he speaks to Saul, he says, the God that's with me, he's enabled me to defeat the lion and the bear. Where were these? God's now using David in a public way out in the open. But David, has, in his own life, has been able to defeat the enemy, his Goliath, previously in obscurity. In my own private life, can I defeat my Goliath? If I'm going to be able to do it in the open, I'm going to know the victory in private. And this is one of the secrets of David's life. You read his Psalms. And that, I read Psalm 17 just as an example of how David's thinking went. As you can consider David, how often we just read and we'll get a very good historical account of a person. But David in his Psalms, he bears his soul. And we can see and get an understanding of some of the experiences through which he went and how he could rest on God. And as we, with time permitting, we just want to have a look at that a little later. But we see him defeating the enemy. It's at this time that David and Jonathan form a tremendous friendship. And if we want to know how to be a friend, if we want to know what friends to try to cultivate, have a look at Jonathan and David. I think Jonathan, it's one thing I think each of us should desire and have the ambition to be a friend like Jonathan. And there was four things that struck me as I considered Jonathan and David's friendship, but they're all on Jonathan's side. And firstly this, their friendship was pure in its origins. Read the story, we haven't got time to go into it. It was unselfish in its motives. And at their first association we find Jonathan, who's Saul's son, at their first meeting, Jonathan gives David his raiment. Now in the Eastern custom that was very significant. It was steadfast in spite of opposition. Now you read this story and you see the tremendous strength of this friendship. And then fourthly, we find that Jonathan, and nearly every time you read about Jonathan meeting David and they were under some pressing circumstances, we read that Jonathan strengthened David or encouraged him in the Lord. My friends, do they meet this criteria? Do I search for Christian friends who meet this, or do I treat Christians as acquaintances and have my friends outside? It should be the other way around. As a person, am I trying to be a friend that meets these criteria? As an assembly, we should have, each one of us should be friends, and we should strengthen one another in the Lord, and we should encourage. Then Paul writes and says we should edify. Do my actions strengthen my fellow believers? It challenged me during the week. I had a young person to give the devotion on Tuesday night. There was 8 people here to listen to him, including one child. Was that encouraging this person in the Lord? Now the person is responsible and accountable, and maybe he can grow in the Lord despite our friendship. But do we display it? It's easy to talk about it. But do we display it in our life? The friendship that was characterised by Jonathan. Let's look at dealing with persecution. It took a tremendous part of David's life. And you read the Psalms, and they really challenge me, and I can see how David rested in the Lord. Now, with this persecution, the pressure, if you read the story, you can see how the pressure continues to build up in David's life. We'll just go a little way down some of the incidents that had happened to David. After he defeated Goliath, he spends a lot more time in Saul's company. After that incident with Goliath, we read that it says, we know that David had spent time playing music even while still a lad for Saul to bring him back when he went off his rail, to bring him back some sanity. And then David, you'd go in for a while and he'd go back to look after the sheep. And when the battle was on with the Philistines, David was back looking after the sheep. By this stage, he'd grown, and he might have been 20 by that stage. And it says this, that Saul wanted to know about his family. Now, maybe Saul didn't recognise David, and that's quite possible if he's gone from grown up into manhood. I got caught with that just a few weeks ago. The guy's here today, and I hadn't seen him for 3 or 4 years, and I saw him in an area where I didn't expect to see him, and I didn't recognise him. Very embarrassing for me, and I guess embarrassing for him too. But also, when Saul had also promised that whoever defeated Goliath would be his son-in-law, he would give his daughter to them. And David wants to know all about David. Now, maybe he didn't know who he was, and that's possible. But also, if you were going to have someone as your son-in-law, you'd want to know a bit about their family, wouldn't you? It's a general response. So, anyway, we're coming to Saul's persecution of David and how the pressure builds up. Saul's wary of David, and we see the jealousy displayed because David is much more victorious in battle than Saul. And it really gets under Saul's skin to find that the people are acknowledging the greatness of David, and they say that Saul slays his thousands and David his tens of thousands. So what's Saul going to do? He's promised his first daughter Merab to David as his wife, and he doesn't like this idea at all because he's a bit worried about David. So he gives her to someone else, and then he says to David, in the meantime, he decides, I've got to get rid of David. I've got to get him killed. What's the easiest way? I'll make him a captain in the army and put him out into the forefront, and then the Philistines will kill him and I won't have to. Then that doesn't work, or it hasn't succeeded. And then his younger daughter, Michal, falls in love with David, and she wants him. And Saul says, got to get rid of him. So he says to David, or he sends a message to David, that he can have Michal if he kills 100 Philistines by a certain date. So David goes and kills 200 before the time. So that really makes it a bit hard for Saul, doesn't it? So he's got to have... So now he's got him as a son-in-law. Getting too close. He throws a javelin at him twice while he's trying to soothe him with some music. And then he surrounds David's and Michael's house to capture him, and he's going to kill him. Now, I don't know how you'd respond to pressure like that. I'm not sure how I'd respond, but let's listen to how David says, what David does. And you read Psalm 59, and this is when he writes Psalm 59. And if you read the first 8 verses, he casts himself upon the Lord. He is really at the end of himself. He's virtually saying, the pressure's too much. And then as he's praying, you from verses 9 to 15 in Psalm 59, you see he progresses into a quiet confidence in God. And then in the end of the psalm, he bursts into a victorious song. Now, if you notice the psalm, look at the names he uses for God in the psalm. He says he's my strength when I'm weak, my fortress when I'm surrounded by my enemies, and he says he's my mercy. In these circumstances, you've shown me thy pity. Now, the fact that he rejoices in God hasn't removed the pressure. You read on in David's story, and after this, the pressure only increases. After this, Saul sends messengers to go and capture him. He's gone to Ramah, I think, yes, with Samuel the prophet. And he sends messengers to go and capture him. And you look how God overrules. They come back, and Saul's had enough by this time. He goes himself, and we again see how God overrules. Has the pressure reduced? No way. As a matter of fact, it's got even more intense, and we see David and Jonathan talking again together in Samuel chapter 20. And David is perplexed. The pressure is getting tremendous. And he talks to Jonathan and he says, where am I going to turn, basically? What am I going to do? Saul's trying to kill me. What am I going to do? And they have a pact. And Jonathan says, I'll find out how Saul is. And I'll come out with a lad tomorrow and I'll fire 3 arrows. And depending on what I say will depend on whether you can come back, be with your wife, enjoy the friendship that's mine, have the role in the court and be brought up, we would say, in training to take over what is yours. The alternative is exile, leaving Jonathan, leaving his family, and be, as he could say during this time of persecution, like a partridge on the mountains. David had no say in what God had for him. And David accepts it. Every prop on which David leaned was taken away. But he still had God. And Jonathan comes out the next day, it's 3 days, and Jonathan finds out at almost the cost of his life, because Saul tries to kill Jonathan. But we see again how strong this friendship is of Jonathan's. And it's interesting, he comes out and he fires, and they talk about the stones. And the meaning of those stones is the stone that shapeth. On one hand, David could go this way, on the other hand, the other. And David has to go. Can you imagine the thoughts of David's heart? To linger would cost him his life, the crown, and everything God had planned for him. and there was no promise of relief from the pressure. You read Psalm 57. And it was at this time, and he could rest on God to perform. And as I thought of David, I thought all he had was God's promise that he was going to be king. And I thought about Peter. Now, remember in John 21, the Lord had said to Peter that you're young and you'll do this, but when you're old, another will take you. And he told him that he'd be crucified when he was an old man. It's not all that long after this. Peter's in prison. John's been beheaded. And Peter is to be killed the next day. And I reckon the only Christian that was asleep that night, because we find the rest of them are praying, the only Christian that we find sleeping is Peter. Now, how did Peter sleep? May I suggest this? He was resting on God's promise that when he was old, he would die. He was leaving it to God to look after. Can I rest on God's promises? David did, because you read Psalm 57 and he virtually says he was resting on God to perform. So David now has to go out into exile. He leaves everyone. He goes into a cave. Later on, he can get his family come with him. And then he finally has to send his family away to Moab. And you say, why Moab? But remember, Ruth and all the generations, so you probably find there's some relations back there. But we see the providence of God dealing with David. Time's gone. Can we rest on God too? In his providence, the promises that he's made for us, or do we want to take so many things into our own hand? We see him dealing with Nabal. Now, as a younger person, you read that story, read about Nabal, look at the difference in character of Nabal and Abigail. Now, maybe we could say, oh yeah, we could understand that they had arranged marriages. And that may be so. But today we don't. And how many times do we see such a combination together when we have a say in who's our partner for life? What do we look for in our partner for life? Do we pray about it? Do we look about it? Just read that story about David and when he deals with Nabal and Abigail, just the story of Nabal and Abigail and their differences. Forgetting about the story of David, but there's a tremendous lesson for David, how he learns from Abigail not to take things into his own hand. We see his despondency when he goes down to Ziklag. And it's interesting, he gives up, and you read Psalm 13, I think it's Psalm 13, and four times he says, how long, how long, how long, how long? And he does something, he compromises, and Saul stops pursuing him. He says in his own, David says in his heart, he says, if I do this, so I won't have the battle with it, Saul. And how often do we compromise to avoid the battle for which we know is right? As you read the story, we see God's dealing in grace with David and how he overrules to keep him out of a terrible situation where he was going to march. He was prepared to go and march with the Philistines against Israel, and God intervenes. After that, we find how God overrules and he becomes king of Judah. And this is almost 20 years from the first point we discussed where God calls him. Now, what patience. Now, for a young man, for a young person, we all usually want things done yesterday. David had tremendous patience because he could rest on God. I think about his divided house. I've got to close. As parents, how many times are there things in our children's life in which we get wroth, and we read about that in David in this case of Absalom and Tamar and Ammon, but he couldn't discipline them because of things in his own life. It's a challenge to us as parents. As a young person, what type of forgiveness, or as an older person too, what effect has forgiveness had in my life? We see one of the problems with forgiveness in family situation on the human level, we usually forgive and it's at the expense of justice. And we see that really brought out in David's experience with Absalom. David didn't know how to punish him. He kept wanting to, but he couldn't. But it had absolutely no effect on Absalom's life. I mean, here he was forgiven, and he's plotting against his father. But look at the effect that forgiveness had with David. It made sin abhorrent to David. In our own experience, God's forgiveness with us, has it made sin abhorrent to me? That's the effect it should have. Oh, that, I've got to close. Oh, that the epitaph that would be written over each one of our lives that could be said by God is this, that each one of us were men and women after God's own heart. Just read his story. Have a look at it this week. I've put some of the Psalms that are related and associated with some of his experiences there, so that as you read his experience, you can see something of the attitude of David's heart and what it had on him. And may it challenge each one of us this week to live more closely to the Lord and be more like David. You look at the history in the Old Testament and how nearly all the kings are compared to David. It says, but he didn't do this like David his father, or he didn't follow the Lord, and they're compared to David. May we be followers of David as he was of the Lord, the same as Paul could say, be followers of me as I am of Christ. May it be our desire today.